suicide. Armed crew emerged from the U-boat and led Lawrence, then Bennett, down into the submarine, separating them into different quarters. As the U-boat dove below, several explosions sounded overhead. Another patrol must have spotted them. Speaking English, the submarine captain interrogated Bennett for information on British minefields in the channel, but Bennett denied knowing anything about those. "Then we might all be blown up together," the captain warned. "That suits me fine," Bennett said, unwilling to talk. For the next 19 hours, Bennett and Lawrence remained in the submarine as it laid its own mines. Finally, they docked at Zeebrugge, and the men were transferred to a civil prison in Bruges. Bennett was questioned by a German intelligence officer who, in return for his cooperation, promised to send him to a lovely seaside camp on the Baltic to bathe, play tennis, and generally have a wonderful time. All he had to do was share what he knew about the British fleet and a potential attack on the Belgian coast. Bennett divulged nothing. Over the next week, these interrogations continued. He and Lawrence were given very little food or exercise, and only a cache of chocolate provided any comfort. On May 30th, the day his mother received notice from the Admiralty, telling her of her son's capture, Bennett wrote her his first letter from captivity. It began, "As you see, I am a prisoner of war, but you do not want to worry about me, as I am quite all right. I must say that we are being treated very well here." He asked after her vegetable garden, sent his best to the family, and concluded, "I am your loving son." From Bruges, Bennett and Lawrence were sent by train to Germany. They were weak from hunger, idleness, and long hours of interrogation. The train stopped at a POW camp for enlisted ranks, and the next morning they were put into the fields to work with them. The two airmen learned that the Dutch border was only 30 miles away. It would have been an easy run into the woods, but such was their depleted physical condition that neither Bennett nor Lawrence even contemplated such a move. The next day, the two were put on a train, this time with little guard. The cars rattled down the track so slowly that had they excused themselves to go to the toilet, they could have jimmied open a window and jumped out without injury. Again, neither considered such a possibility. Only after Bennett found himself behind two rectangular sets of high, barbed-wire fences at the Struan prison camp, set in the middle of an empty moor, did he realize that his two best opportunities of escape had passed. The doer in Bennett refused to sit in the dark, dilapidated hut where he was housed and wallow in regret. Straight away, he started to prepare for escape, first by getting back into shape. His fellow officers, most of whom had been transferred from Krefeld, found his propensity to walk around the prison for hours on end somewhat odd. But the distance to the Dutch border amounted to 3 marathons, and with Struan quickly descending into a nightmare of abuse, Bennett would have to make his move soon. Struan, Schwarmstedt, Clausthal, and several other camps under the remit of the 10th Army Corps Division were all now in the hands of General Karl von Heinisch, an ogre of a Prussian officer, as the prisoners would soon learn. On Friday morning, June 8, 1917, David Gray awoke at Schwarmstedt. He shared the small matchboard-walled compartment with 12 other officers, their beds stacked like berths on a steamer ship. Through slits in the uneven, warped roof, they could see clear blue sky. These same slits allowed entry to a host of fleas, flies, and mosquitoes from the surrounding swamp, which mounted a nightly assault on the prisoners. Open latrines, situated 8 feet from the barracks, also allowed the insects to flourish. The stench stung the eyes and nose. 2 weeks before, the prisoners had been welcomed to the camp by its commandant, Colonel Dietz. Close to 70, Dietz was tall and dressed in a resplendently medaled uniform that barely buttoned over his overfed waist. "Gentlemen," he began in a courteous voice, I'm sorry not to be able to welcome you to a better camp. I do not think it a fit camp to put officers, and I think the best thing would be for you to write home and see if you can't get both yourself and myself out of it." He continued, with no apparent order to his thoughts. The rooms would be crowded, so they could be with their friends. He knew all that was to be known about the English, because of a visit to Scotland. The water at the camp was not fit to drink. He then offered to sell the prisoners local maps, so they could know exactly where they were. "You see," he said, "it would be quite useless for you to try to escape, because the whole of this heath is surrounded by impassable bogs." Gray and the others did not know whether the jumbled speech was a calculated threat or simply the ravings of a mad old soldier. The next day, two prisoners tested out his theory about the heath. They cut through the wire fence and ran off. Soon after, half a dozen others followed suit. Still weakened from his stint in solitary confinement and the journey from Krefeld, Gray did not make an attempt. Few made it out of the bogs. None made it to freedom. Soon enough, every prisoner at Schwarmstedt understood two things. They had been sent to Swamp Camp by the German command to suffer, and Dietz was its willing accomplice. That Friday morning, General Hainisch, the 56-year-old officer who had ordered them sent there, was to pay a visit. After a hurried wash at the two water pumps, the prisoners assembled for morning roll call, and Dietz presented the general. On looks alone, there was little to distinguish Hainisch from any other Prussian career officer in the Imperial German Army. Cropped hair, humorless expression, all iron in the frame. The prisoners knew, according to rumors that preceded his visit, that Hainisch had led divisions at the Battle of Arras and the Somme. At both, the British overran his lines to embarrassing effect, and as a result he had been removed from active command. In the early spring of 1917, he was sent back to Germany to run the 10th Army Division. The Poldju also spread the information that Hainisch's son had been killed by the British, and from the moment he swaggered in to address the Schwarmstedt prisoners, it was clear he felt nothing but hatred toward them. After a short speech, in which he shared his recommendation that the prisoners be moved just behind German lines in order to be shelled by their own troops, Hainisch carried out an inspection of the camp. In one room he found a British flag beside a bunk. He ripped it away, shouting, "There is only one flag in Germany!" In another he discovered an unopened tin and chastised a guard, ordering him to inspect it immediately. When the senior British officer recommended that the food be improved and lights allowed in the barracks at night, Hainisch went on a tirade. If the prisoners wanted better conditions, they should send a letter to their prime minister to plead the end of the blockade of Germany. With that, he left the camp in a storm of rage. The next day, guards raided the barracks and confiscated any contraband, including area maps that had been bought by the prisoners. Gray managed to keep his hidden. Fearing that the visit from Hainisch would lead to an increase in patrols or camp defenses, he determined to make an escape attempt as soon as possible with two fellow officers. Their plan was to open the gate by the parcel room. Gray would be disguised as a German private, his two accomplices as orderlies, the three of them setting off to collect wood. Schwarmstedt had a roster of men willing to help them out. One had stolen the gate key from a guard and created a mold of it. A key was then made out of melted-down Lagergeld coins. Another officer helped fashion their uniforms. For the run to the border, another prisoner provided a makeshift compass through a particularly ingenious solution. He engineered the flywheel on a wristwatch to rotate freely on its mount. Then, by running a current from a disassembled light fixture through a sewing needle, he created a magnetized compass pointer. This was fixed onto the flywheel, and the watch face and hands were replaced. It looked like a normal timepiece. While Gray readied their breakout, there were other attempts in the offing, including another pink toes tunnel. this one through soft, peaty ground. Mossy, who had been caught in his tunnel hideout before the transfer from Krefeld, was leading the effort. Gray thought his plan had a better chance of success. With clothes prepared and an assembled kit of food, he and his two partners set off. They got outside the camp easily, but as they crossed toward the cart track, Dietz and his lieutenant emerged from their nearby quarters. Gray kept his cool, giving Dietz a firm salute, and the three continued on without incident. They did not make it far. At evening roll call, they were missed, and Dietz sent out a hunting party that captured them in the bog. A few days later, at sunset, a fire broke out on the heath. Its heat and gray plumes colored the sky in wondrous layers of pink and orange. Gray saw none of it, confined to a thin-walled solitary cell, baking under its tarred roof. He could only choke on the thick smoke. 75 miles south, in Clausthal, Blaine and Kennard endured their punishment for the revenge attack on Alouche. For almost 2 months, the two men were in solitary confinement, inhabiting 10-by-6-foot cells between a pigsty and a mechanic's shed on the northern end of the camp. The maddening squeals of the pigs bothered them more than the tight confines and the absence of windows. At the end of May, at long last, they were allowed out. They had not bathed or exercised in weeks. They had to shield their eyes from the piercing sun coming over the Harz Mountains, and the short walk to their rooms in the former Peacock Hotel was a trial. Commandant Wolf, or Pig Face, so called by the men for his bald, round head, puffy face, and tiny, closely spaced eyes, had stripped Clausthal of everything that had once made it a tourist resort. 6 officers crowded into each guest room, and the overflow was housed in wooden barracks. Mattresses were replaced with wooden planks and straw palliasses. Guards roused any prisoner sleeping past 7 a.m. and limited the 260 imprisoned officers to 4 showerheads, whose pressure was little more than a trickle. They had a better chance of washing themselves by squeezing a damp rag over their heads. Flies infested the latrines, meals were rushed, roll calls were deliberately drawn out, and searches were frequent. Sentries and guard dogs patrolled the fence, and all parcels, including those from the Red Cross, were hacked apart to test for contraband. Hainish instructed his staff, "Cut up their soap in pieces, cut up their bread in slices, and remember, you are a German." The prisoners made the best of the limited grounds available to them. They laid tennis courts and imported a net at their own expense. They built a 6-hole golf course, staged boxing matches, and organized a theater troupe, bridge tournament, gambling den, and language instruction. When allowed out on parole, on the promise not to escape, they hiked through the pine-forested hillsides under a limited guard. Compared to their solitary cells, the camp was a paradise to Blaine and Kennard. As is the case in most such institutions, the prisoners tended to congregate with those of like mind. Some groups were content to do nothing but entertain themselves. Others passed their days reading and studying. Others were do-nothings. Blaine and Kennard were a different breed. They fell into the small but distinct class of Clausthal men that one veteran labeled escape fiends. They were indefatigable. It began with tunnels. Kennard was invited to join a breakout effort underneath one of the wooden barracks. Then he brought Blaine into the fold. It was tough going. The sap needed to be only 10 yards in length to reach beyond the fence, but the earth was a mix of granite and shale, and it took hours of digging to proceed just a few inches. The work also caused quite a din. During the noisiest stretches, the tunnelers tried to distract the guards by holding boisterous tennis matches. Their effort would have continued, but Commandant Wolf discovered a separate tunnel scheme in progress, initiating under the stage the prisoners had built for their makeshift theater. Any further digging would have been a fool's errand. One of the other escape fiends, William Cahoon, decided on a new course, directly through the wire. The Canadian lieutenant, 28 years old and 6 foot 6 inches tall, had proved his mettle on the front, leading a platoon to take out German snipers and sapper teams. In early 1915, he earned the Military Cross while retrieving from the front line, under intense fire, a mortally wounded officer. A month later, during a scouting mission in No Man's Land, he was knocked senseless and half buried in dirt by an explosion. His platoon mates thought him dead. When his German captor brought him into the trenches, he looked Cahoon up and down and asked, "Are all Canadians as tall as you?" To which Cahoon responded, "Well, they call me Shorty." One day, in broad daylight, Cahoon cut a hole in the fence around Clausthal, stepped through it, and ran. Such was the brazenness of the attempt that the guards were oblivious to his flight. Some children playing in pine woods outside the camp spotted him on the run, but none of the guards believed their tale. By the time Wolfe determined that Cahoon was gone, the Canadian was far away. A week into his 212-mile flight to the border, he was captured by a German soldier searching for an escaped Russian prisoner. Hours after being sent to the nearest internment camp, Cahoon busted through a skylight in his cell. He was caught again 3 days later by some trackers with dogs. Undeterred, he used his long arms to grab the keys to his cell door through the spy aperture used by the guards. Starving and exhausted, he stole a bicycle and pedaled to the north. The bike broke, and while trying to fix it, he was detained yet again. This time, he was returned to Clausthal. A squadron mate of Blaine's, John Tullis, hatched a plot of his own. One afternoon, he dug a shallow ditch by the fence between the two tennis courts, ostensibly as part of his grounds repair duties. Then, when the guards were distracted, he lay down in the ditch, flat on his chest and holding some wire clippers, and had a friend cover him with 8 inches of dirt. He kept his left arm positioned near his head so he could read his luminous wristwatch. By breathing through a pipe shaped like a snorkel, camouflaged at the top with a tuft of grass, Tullis planned to remain there until nightfall. An accomplice would answer his name at roll call. Once it was dark, Tullis would climb out of the trench, then cut his way through the fence to freedom. After the bugle of evening roll call, the yard cleared. In the silence, buried in dirt, Tullis wanted nothing more than to wriggle free, or at the very least, roll onto his side, but he knew he had to remain motionless. The time passed slowly. Finally, a check of his watch showed it soon would be dark. Only a few minutes longer now. Just as he was about to begin his escape, he heard a muffled chuckle coming from above him, then felt the dirt being scooped away from around his head. A guard, triumphant in his discovery, was looming over him. He had either spotted the tube, or some slight involuntary shift from Tullis had alerted him to his hiding place. Blaine and Kennard were just as bent on escape. Always on the lookout for opportunity, they had detected a vulnerability in Clausthal's defenses. There were a number of gates leading into the camp, which the Germans, confident that nobody could pick their locks, did not post sentries beside. Blaine and Kennard managed to briefly obtain a set of keys from an unsuspecting guard, and an impression was made in a bar of soap. Using the mold, they then cut their own set of keys out of a sardine can. While Blaine hid in a nearby shed, Kennard had a go at one of the gate locks. But to no end. No matter his frustrated attempts, the keys didn't fit, and the two men were almost caught in the act. Following this failed effort, they tried to impersonate a pair of camp workmen and simply walk through the gate. They dyed black some clothes received from their families to resemble the outfits worn by the workers. They also forged papers, using a typewriter for the text and an official stamp made with the lid of a small tin, a 2-mark silver piece, and the ink from a toy printing set sold in the canteen, of all places. They had only made it a few steps past the gate when the guards got wise to their scheme and hauled them back inside. Wolfe confiscated their escape kit and sentenced them to solitary once more. The punishment wielded at Clausthal for prisoners attempting escape was a far cry from the medieval practice of hacking off the feet of escapees, or, during the American Civil War, branding with a T the foreheads of those caught tunneling out of captivity. The Hague Conventions offered sparse protection for escapees, since punishments were considered subject to the military law of the host nation. The German War Book, the handbook of the Imperial German General Staff, stated that prisoners could be sentenced to death for so much as plotting an escape, but allowed the commanding officer to decide if a restriction of privileges and sharper supervision was adequate punishment. Rumor had it that Hainisch had recently instituted a sentence of 5 months solitary confinement for any officer trying to escape. Such lengths in isolation could break a man. Whatever the truth, Wolfe did seem to have some discretion on how to respond to escape attempts. Tullis received 40 days, Kennard and Blaine, 14. As well as these individual punishments, Wolfe made life at Clausthal collectively harder for its prisoners. Parole walks were stopped, and room searches became ransacks. The commandant was aided by a host of willing lieutenants. Shooting Sam, as the prisoners called him, liked to pop off rifle shots to warn any inmate standing too near the fence. Whistling Rufus, a cross-eyed detective from Berlin, searched the camp for contraband with a dog he summoned with a piercing shriek. Then there was Windy Dick, Heinrich Niemeyer, by his Christian name, a boorish, bullet-headed figure with a square jaw, who claimed he had learned to speak English while working for a time in America. He threw tantrums over the men's failure to properly salute him, or for any infraction of the rules, and he constantly suspected the prisoners of plotting escapes, for which he threatened the severest of punishments. "Because I say, you know, that is enough for you," he would warn in one of his bedeviling English idioms. Some of the prisoners believed the escape fiends were the source of all their troubles at the camp, and began to frown on any breakout attempt. General Hurtis Ravenshaw, the senior British officer at Clausthal, warned his charges that he would have any potential escapee court-martialed on his return to England. The War Office was as ambiguous about escape as the Germans were about punishment for same. According to its 1907 military manual, a British soldier faced court-martial if he failed to rejoin His Majesty's service when able to rejoin the same. In law, the phrase, "when able," was subject to interpretation. Blaine felt no duty to abide by Ravenshaw's dictate, nor did he feel compelled to escape because of what some military lawyers in London had written before the war. He simply wanted to be free and far away from his captors, whom he despised to his very core. Kennard felt the same. Wolfe made sure the two inveterate breakout artists would not be teaming up together again. To their chagrin, the commandant removed Kennard to a different camp, breaking their partnership. Undaunted, Blaine partnered with Captain Edward Legat, whom he had known since Osnabrück. An RFC pilot, Legat had won acclaim shooting down 2 German Albatross planes on one of his first missions in France. He and Blaine managed to break into an attic storeroom in the former hotel, where they discovered a bounty that included 2 bottles of 1811 brandy, crates of sausages, bacon, and chocolate, and an arsenal of rifles, revolvers, and ammunition. The weapons they left alone, the brandy they drank, the food they kept for their hike to the border, and the storeroom they used to forge new documents and prepare a new plan of escape. Part 2. All roads lead to Helmenden. Chapter 7. Swamp Camp was no place to dig a tunnel. Underneath Schwarmstedt's top layer of black sand, the ground was crumbly peat. Any effort to dig sufficiently deep left one kneeling in a small pool of water. To the amazement of Will Harvey, the Pinktoes made the attempt, starting their sap under the floorboards of a utility shed. The peat gave way easily to digging. Within a couple of weeks, the tunnel stretched beyond the fence, but never at a depth of more than a few feet underground. It was so shallow that anyone digging in the tunnel could feel the footsteps of the men walking above. Before dawn, on June 27th, They cleared away the last yard of dirt. The tunnel opened out into the main ditch that drained water from the camp. Mossy led the way out that same morning, followed by Captain William Moritz of the East Surrey Regiment. Four others were crawling down the tunnel when the first shot cracked out. Forewarned somehow about the escape, guards fired on Moritz at close range from the bridge, only 5 yards away. He tumbled into the ditch, a bullet through his lung. As Mossy sprinted off, two more rifle shots sounded. He fell too, hit badly in the arm. Guards seized him as the other Pinktos crept backward in their tunnel before they were caught. Moritz died soon after, drowned in his own blood. Harvey called the 24-year-old infantry officer one of the bravest and gentlest souls I ever knew. 2 days later, Harvey and 80 other officers marched behind a cart carrying Moritz's coffin to a small church in a neighboring village. The Germans permitted a military burial with a firing party and a bugler trumpeting out the last post, but there was no British flag to drape over the coffin. Every officer present considered Moritz's death a murder, but there was little they could do about it. Their helplessness stung. Mossy was sent to a hospital for treatment, then on to another camp. Life at Schwarmstedt continued on, as if the shootings had never occurred. The dreaded routine of roll calls, meals cooked in sandpits, and interminable conversations centering on how long the war would last. The summer heat was relentless, and the men spent their days in shorts, singlets, and bare feet. Many shaved their heads in an attempt to stay cool and clean. There was never enough soap for washing, and their water supply was filthy brown and polluted by leakage from the open latrines. They had to pay for drinking water, which was the same filthy water, only filtered. At night, fleas and mosquitoes attacked them with abandon under the glare of arc lamps. On July 9th, Dr. Rudolf Rohmer visited the camp. Rohmer was the Dutch attaché assigned to inspect German camps for compliance with the Hague Conventions. Despite noting the need for netting on windows, better water, fresh vegetables, and clean latrines, he reported back to British officials that there has never been a case of ill treatment by the Germans. The officers looked healthy and were in good spirits. About Moritz's shooting, only the briefest mention was made. After Rohmer left, the prisoners learned through the Paldieu that Germany and Britain had met in The Hague to review POW and civilian internment conditions. From what they could make out, officers from both countries, who had been held for more than 18 months, would soon be sent to neutral Holland and Switzerland, where they would remain until the end of the war. In addition, the warring parties agreed that punishment for escape would be limited to a 2-week maximum sentence in solitary, except in extreme cases. The timeline and numbers approved for transfer kept shifting, and Gray and the other officers in solitary confinement remained in their cells. The inmates who brought them meals made note of their poor condition. Although physically fine, Harvey had fallen deeper into a desperate mental state that prisoners of the time referred to as barbed wire disease. The wearisome sameness of the days, the monotony of the faces, the unchanged landscape, the intolerable talk about the war, all these tended to produce the effect of complete and utter depression, one prisoner wrote. This was far and away our worst enemy. Whole days were drenched in incurable melancholia. Harvey likened the effect of barbed wire disease to a green mold that grew thick on his mind, leaving him stale and incapable of joy. His poem, Prisoners, gave voice to this state. Laugh, oh, laugh loud. All yet too long ago, adventure sought in gallant company, safe in stagnation, laugh. Laugh heartily. While on this filthiest backwater of time's flow, drift we and rot till something set us free. Laugh like old men with senses atrophied, heeding no present, to the future dead. Nodding quite foolish by the warm fireside, and seeing no flame, but only I the red and flickering embers, pictures of the past. Life like a cinder, fading black at last. Determined to be rid of the feeling, Harvey was finally spurred to escape. He copied a map onto some paper from a biscuit tin, acquired a homemade compass, and sewed a knapsack to hold food. His idea, hatched on a visit to the parcel room outside the wire one day, was simple. He would sneak into the second floor of the building, hide out until after dark, then leap from its lone window onto an adjacent telegraph pole. A quick slide down to the ground, and he would be off. He was almost ready to go when a friend alerted him to the fact that the guards had recently wrapped the base of the pole with barbed wire. Looking for another opportunity to escape, but growing moldier by the day, the poet found himself struggling to write anything other than letters home. In these, he lamented his loss of ability to craft the work that gave meaning to his life. There was a new commandant at Stroen, Captain Karl Niemeyer. He was the twin brother of Heinrich Windy Dick, stationed at Clausthal, and of similar bent. Karl Niemeyer intended to show the roughly 400 prisoners in his charge that order and obedience would be paramount under his watch. In his previous role as camp adjutant, he'd been loathed by his charges, Kennard and Bennett among them. His elevation to commandant only deepened the men's contempt for him. Tall and stout, Niemeyer was built like an upright rectangle. Except for his mutton chops and bushy eyebrows, his bowling ball of a head was pasty white and cleanly shaved. Typically, he wore a military cap perched at a rakish angle. A bully of the first order, he had a rash temper and a thin skin. He often skulked bow-legged about the camp in his starched uniform and high cavalry boots, chomping on a cigar, while looking for trouble like a dog would a bone. No slight from a prisoner. A weak salute, a roll of the eyes, an impertinent remark went unnoticed or unpunished. Such was his character that there were few pejoratives not cast his way by the prisoners in their diaries and other accounts. He was a cad, a low-bred ruffian, the personification of hate, a bloated, pompous, crawling individual, a man of unbridled ferocity and bravado, a cheat, a plausible rogue, and a coward with all the attributes of one. He deceives, he is cruel, he blusters, he is dishonest, he cringes. Prone to apoplectic fits of rage, typically while brandishing a large revolver or his knobbed walking cane, Niemeyer scolded and threatened prisoners with a zeal that left him red-faced and panting for breath. The root of his grievances was unclear, and given his propensity to tell lies, his background was in question. Although born in Germany, he and his twin brother spent 17 years living in the United States. He might have tended bar in Milwaukee. He might have built billiard tables in New York. He might have done both. His stories changed as often as he told them. He had learned enough English to slaughter the language wholesale. After President Wilson declared war, or before, if one cared about logical timelines, Niemeyer fled across the Atlantic. Such was his perilous escape that he was awarded the Iron Cross, though there was no proof of this, nor of his claim that he had worked undercover in England as a spy for the Kaiser. Despite being in his 60s, he had also fought at the Somme for 1 week, he said, which had been enough for him. There was no doubt, however, that the Niemeyer twins were exactly what Hainish was looking for, and he elevated them both to key positions in his network of prison camps. They followed his instructions assiduously when it came to the treatment of POWs. On his first day in command, August 4th, 1917, Niemeyer proved how capable he was of malevolence. Newcomers were frequent at Stroen, and the prisoners typically congregated by the fences to watch them arrive and welcome them. These arrivals were boisterous affairs, complete with shouting and festive reunions. Niemeyer declared that such gatherings would no longer take place, effective immediately. In the early evening, guards brought 15 British officers to the eastern gate, and they were made to enter one at a time. Ignoring Niemeyer's order, a group of prisoners approached the fence to cheer those arriving, and warned them to expect an intensive search. The new commandant watched the scene unfold through his office window, as the number of men forming a semicircle by the gate continued to increase. He stamped from his office to the nearest sentry box, waving his cap at his guards and screaming for them to make use of their arms to drive the men away. Bayonets fixed, four guards moved toward the prisoners. Los! Los! Niemeyer yelled for them to charge. The prisoners began to back away from the fence, but not quickly enough for the guards. Lieutenant Downs, a former medical student, who had come out of his hut to see what the commotion was about, received a bayonet in his back for his curiosity. In shock, he turned toward the guard, who then plunged the blade into his side, narrowly missing his kidney. Two other prisoners were also stabbed, one of them deflecting with his arm what might have been a mortal blow. As Downs staggered and fell to the ground, blood pouring through his singlet, mayhem was unleashed in the camp. More guards moved forward, and those stationed in the sentry boxes readied their machine guns. With roughly 100 guards and 400 prisoners, there would likely have been a massacre were it not for the cool-headed thinking of one British officer who began singing God Save the King at the top of his voice. Other prisoners added their voices to his, and soon the whole camp was standing to attention and belting out the song. The guards backed off. When the yard quieted down, the prisoners carried Downs and the other two wounded officers to the camp hospital. They survived, even though they were without medical attention for almost 3 hours. When the senior British officer went to see Niemeyer about the attack, the commandant had already departed for the day. Later, when asked to account for his order, he declared, "I had nothing to do with it at all. I was not in the camp. I did not give the order." Such was the men's introduction to the leadership of Karl Niemeyer. After Niemeyer became commandant, prisoners could not beat a quick enough path from Stroen. Bennett was chief among those determined to escape. By his third month in captivity, he was back in shape, involved in a tunneling scheme, and collecting an escape kit from parcels sent by his mother. Beyond sentiments of making the best of a bad job, his letters home always included a list of items he needed, ostensibly for his life as a POW, but especially intended for a run to the border. These included easy-to-pack dried fruits, hard biscuits, a traveling rug, strong boots, warm clothes, and a canvas kit bag. Since arriving at Stroen, Bennett had made his intention to escape clear to his fellow officers. After only a few weeks there, some veteran prisoners asked him and his New Zealander bunkmate Roy Fitzgerald if they would be interested in digging a tunnel with them. Started by some Russians, who had since been moved to another camp, its entrance was underneath the barracks hut that Bennett, Fitzgerald, and 26 other recent arrivals now occupied. It was a risky proposition. The moorland meant any sap would be a shallow affair, with walls that collapsed easily. Niemeyer knew well the allure of the border, only 70 miles away, and he pressed his guards to remain vigilant to any breakout attempt. He offered a 20-mark reward and 14 days leave for thwarting any such escape, as well as the threat of transfer to the front should his subordinates fail to do so. The heightened alert did not dull the feverish digging efforts of Bennett and his fellow tunnelers, nor the handful of other schemes in the works. Bennett carefully observed and learned from all their methods, most notably those of Lieutenant Gerald Knight. Knight had been part of the gang at Osnabrück that carried out the revenge attack on Captain Alouche. At Stroen, he'd concocted a plan to build, and eventually hide behind, a false wall in an alcove in the bathhouse that stood outside the wire. To match the color of his cardboard wall to the real one, he made a paste of cornstarch mixed with dirt and cobwebs. His deception worked, and Knight made a successful lone run to Holland. Bennett and his fellow tunnelers had no such luck. Only a week after the assault on Downs, a heavy rainstorm flooded the Stroen Moor. when a guard on patrol crossed over the sap. His boot sank right into it. Niemeyer ordered the tunnel dug up to determine its starting point. Some of the officers congregated to watch, yielding one of them a jab with a bayonet. The tunnel led to the floor underneath where Bennett and Fitzgerald bunked. Of the 28 in the barracks, they were the only two involved in the scheme. But when they attempted to give themselves up to save the others from punishment, the senior officer in their barracks ordered them to remain silent. Niemeyer threw the lot of them into solitary. Day after day, the Germans interrogated them, trying to trick them into revealing who had participated in the digging. The guards told them that several others had already confessed, and they only wanted to cross off the names on the list of those who were innocent. None of the British officers took the bait, and Niemeyer grew more incensed by the week. After the discovery of the tunnel, and a rash of other escape attempts, Niemeyer was forced to bring in reinforcements. Even though he was stewing away in a cell, Bennett found comfort in the knowledge that in order to assist Niemeyer, young, fit German soldiers were being drawn away from the fighting on the front lines. David Gray had very little left to give. Pale and listless, he emerged from his isolation cell at Schwarmstedt into the bright summer day. A guard led him to one of the water pumps to bathe, and a crowd of prisoners gathered around him, his poor condition stirring them to emotion. "What is it like?" one called out. Gray barely managed to look up. He knew better than to speak while out for his twice-weekly bath, but wanted them to know. "Very bad," he uttered, almost broken. Then he returned to his cell. The space measured only a few square feet. There was a single barred window, too high up to see anything but an angle of the sky. Since the window was never opened, the only fresh air he enjoyed came through the uneven slits in the roof. He spent most days and nights baking in the heat of the cell, whose tarred roofs and thin walls acted like a furnace. He sweated constantly, and his body was pocked with insect bites. The only respite from the heat was during the occasional thunderstorm, when rain leaked through those same breaks in the roof. The guards permitted him no books, no pen and paper. 1 hour of exercise was allowed a day. Meals were the only other interruption, and these were pushed through a slot in the door. On occasion, a fellow prisoner bringing his soup or a donated tin of food would offer a kind word of encouragement. Then Gray would return to his solitary plight. Life in the regular camp was conveyed to him in the distant summons to roll call, the indistinct voice of a passing guard, or a muffled tramping of feet, perhaps signaling a breakout. A good military man, Gray would have made the effort to remain in shape while in his cell. But as July staggered into August, he was a shadow of his former self. Even so, thoughts of escape burned inside him. He determined to make his next attempt his final one. Any successful escape, he understood from his failures, would need to be a four-stage event. Intense preparation, a foolproof breakout, an evasion scheme, and a bid to cross the border. At any of these stages, the entire effort could fall apart. One was no less important than the other, and each demanded thorough planning, resolve, quick wits, and a measure of good luck. Toward the end of August, Gray was led out into the yard, free from his confinement. Guards led him, and several others, who had languished in solitary, on foot to Hottemstorf, 5 miles away, then onto a train bound for Stroen. He was there only a short while before Karl Niemeyer was replaced by another commandant. Hainisch was forming a new camp in a town called Holzminden, intended to hold the most troublesome, escape-prone British officers in Germany. He needed an iron fist to oversee them. Chapter 8. Charles Rathbone looked out into the dark night of September 11th, 1917, from a train headed northward from Heidelberg. Crowded into his carriage were 2 dozen other British officers. They passed town after town, but except for a brief stop in Kassel, the train never slowed, thwarting a plan by several prisoners to leap from a window. They were all destined for Holzminden, the first group to be sent to the new camp. Although a student of German, Rathborn could be forgiven for never having heard of the town south of Hanover in Lower Saxony. Founded in 1245 at the edge of the river Weser by Count Otto von Eberstein, it had little of which to boast. Its medieval timber buildings had been leveled by fire during the Thirty Years' War, a 17th-century struggle that only World War I would top in terms of cataclysmic destruction across Europe. In the centuries that followed, the town had been home to iron foundries, a monastery, school, some craftsmen guilds, and most recently a fragrance company. Specialists, by some accounts, in the manufacture of the scent of vanilla and violets. At the outset of war, Holzminden was little more than a garrison town of roughly 10,000 people. The inhabitants of the red-roofed village had the benefit of a picturesque location, set on a broad plain, cut through by the silver-dappled Weser, surrounded by small farms, extensive beech and fir forests, and rolling hills. Rathborn and the others saw none of this during their nighttime approach, but expectations about their future camp were high. According to the Pauldieu, it was to be a prisoner's mecca. Fine, brand-new buildings, spacious grounds, good scenery, good air. They had no way of knowing whether this was true, but the very possibility fostered much debate, both skeptical and hopeful. Rathborn did not have enough experience of the German archipelago of camps to know which side to agree with. Just months earlier, on April 14th, the 31-year-old pilot and RNAS wing commander had led a fighter escort providing cover for a bombing raid on Freiburg. The attack on the city center was in retribution for a number of unanswered atrocities by the Germans, including the death by firing squad of Edith Cavell, a British nurse who helped scores of Allied prisoners escape from occupied Belgium. The treatment of POWs, notably the many who died of typhoid at camps such as Wittenberg, and the recent torpedoing of a hospital ship. After the bombers dropped their eggs, Rathborn turned to escort the squadron home. Suddenly, a pack of German Albatross fighter planes struck. In the flurry of gunfire, Rathborn's engine was hit, and his observer killed. Forced to land behind enemy lines, he was quickly seized. He was a great prize for the Germans, a lieutenant colonel and the Freiburg killer. They paraded him through the streets and pasted his photograph in the national papers. Broad-shouldered, thick-set, and of medium height, Charles Rathborn had soft features and a welcome smile. One likened his visage to the face of an archbishop, a description that belied his natural grit and ambition. Private school educated and fluent in German and Italian, Rathborn joined the Royal Marine Light Infantry on his 18th birthday. He quickly rose through the ranks, his superiors remarking that he was keen, energetic, and very good in taking charge of men. Frequently applied to him was the word zealous. In 1912, sensing that air flight was the future, he trained to become a pilot. At the outbreak of war, he was named a flight commander, then a squadron commander, then placed in charge of an operational wing. The mission that saw him shot down was likely one he could have ordered subordinates to perform. As a POW, Rathborn proved no less ambitious. In May, he arrived at a camp in Karlsruhe, where he assumed the role of senior British officer. He fielded pleas from his fellow officers for better conditions and persuaded the commandant to provide them. Escape was a high priority, but his first effort, in which he planned to walk straight out of the gate in civilian clothes, was foiled by a spy who gave away the hiding place of his escape kit. Before he could concoct a new plan, the order came for transfer to the new camp at Holzminden. It was after midnight when the train finally stuttered to a halt, and Rathborn and the others disembarked. In the 21 hours it had taken to travel from Karlsruhe, they had been given nothing to eat, and had slept only a few halting minutes in the overpacked carriage. They dragged themselves and their few belongings a mile east to the edge of the town. At last, they arrived at the Holzminden officers' camp. The former infantry barracks, built a year before the war, was ringed by tall stone walls and lit by electric arc lamps. Guards directed them through the arched main entrance on the camp's western side. Directly to their right, they passed a small house that served as a guard room, and then entered the main prison grounds through a gate in a barbed wire fence. To their left stood a monolithic stone barracks they would come to know as Block A. A 70-yard gap separated it from its twin, Block B. Although exhausted and desperate for food, they were made to assemble in rows on the cobblestone path in front of the barracks. Beneath the glare of arc lamps, they were forced to wait in the chill of the night. Finally, a tall, beetle-browed German officer, smoking a cigar, strode to the head of the assembly to address them. Captain Karl Niemeyer. None of the prisoners had heard of the camp officer, a position second only to the commandant, and they were surprised when he addressed them in a cheerful, albeit off-kilter, American accent. He opened by saying that he was happy to see them, as he was always glad to see any Englishman, many of whom had been his great friends before the war. He hoped this would be the case again, but in the meanwhile, war was war. He advised that they would be best served, you know, to write straight away to their families and friends, for your thickest clothes, you know. It is very cold here in winter, you know. He concluded, "So now, gentlemen, I expect you will be glad to go to your bedrooms. I will wish you good night. You will be searched in the morning." With that, the guards took them to the third floor of Block A, a four-story whitewashed building with a mansard roof covered in slate. As Rathborn and the others climbed the steps, they wondered if Holzminden might well live up to what the Poldew had promised. Some imagined bedroom candles and a comforting nightcap awaiting them in the barracks. They were divided into three rooms with high ceilings and bare walls. Each room had a stove, but no coal or wood to fuel it. For furniture, each officer had a small cupboard, a stool, and an iron-framed bed whose mattress was filled with straw, wood shavings, and paper. Although they were desperately hungry, the guards offered them no food, and the doors clanged ominously shut when they left. Still, the prisoners continued to hope for the best. In the morning, Rathborn succeeded in keeping hidden the compass he had bribed from a guard at Karlsruhe. He got a good look at Holzminden from the windows. Then later, before roll call, on a walk around the grounds. The prison was a series of secure enclosures, one smaller than the next, like a Russian nesting doll. On the outside was the rectangular stone wall, 8 feet high, topped in places with a barbed-wire palisade angled inward at 120 degrees to prevent climbing. Within this was a half-oval, in the shape of the letter D, protected by a 12-foot-high fence of thick mesh topped by another barbed-wire palisade. A chain of sentry boxes was positioned directly outside this fence. 6 feet separated this enclosure from another barrier, which was the same shape and made from a simple 3-strand wire fence strung on low wood posts. The space in between these two fences was a no-man's land. Prisoners were allowed only within the inner enclosure, which contained the barracks and Spielplatz, a dual parade ground and exercise yard. In a sense, Holzminden was a prison within a prison within a prison, all set 150 miles from the Dutch border. Beyond the security and the buildings themselves, Holzminden was ill-prepared to accommodate the hundreds of POWs sent there, and the guards who oversaw them. The cookhouse lacked any dishes, and there were only 3 cauldrons. There was but a handful of taps and no showers. Nor was there a parcel room or a canteen from which to buy goods. In the light of day, it became clear to the men that Holzminden was no prisoner's Mecca. At morning roll call, the 25 officers gathered on the Spielplatz. Having not eaten in almost 36 hours, they were nearly faint. Beside Niemeyer stood the titular head of the camp, the elderly Colonel Habrecht, who stood by passively as his camp officer addressed the new arrivals. Niemeyer asked if they had breakfasted. The men answered no. Niemeyer promptly ordered his guards to prepare a meal, the likes of which, he promised, you wouldn't get in Regent Street or Piccadilly. The famished British officers salivated at the thought of bacon and grilled sausage. Once dismissed, they hurried into the dining hall on the second floor of Block A, only to be served some tepid acorn coffee. Nothing else. When Rathborn, senior among them, complained, Niemeyer feigned surprise over the men's purported dissatisfaction. Rathborn continued to press him on the men's treatment, reminding him that they were British officers. "You damn well do as I tell you," the camp officer finally said, shutting down further discussion. "If you think you can get out, try." Then he and Colonel Habrecht marched off. They had other prisoners to welcome. As day after day passed, the officers were allotted little more than cabbage soup and small portions of bread to eat. Malnourished and harassed at every turn, they quickly grew to despise Karl Niemeyer. On September 20th, a storm swept across Schwarmstedt, with sand invading every crevice of the camp's huts. The prisoners hunkered down, covering their mouths and noses with wet cloths to help them breathe amid the onslaught. After the storm passed, the men were just beginning to clean up their quarters when the commandant assembled them for an announcement. Following a series of complaints to the British government about conditions at the camp, the men learned Schwarmstedt was to be emptied. Prior to the transfer, a search for contraband ensued. As the guards began opening trunks and pawing through their belongings, Will Harvey grew nervous. After being informed about the camp closing, he had procured a civilian suit in which he might cross the German countryside without arousing suspicion. Civilian clothes were prohibited in the prison, and if the guards found the suit, there would be hell to pay. His plan to jump from the train on the way to the new camp and make his way to the border on foot would be foiled. Moments before the guards arrived at his barracks, Harvey came up with a bold solution. He would don the civvies under his Burberry trench coat, hiding his compass and map in the pockets. Standing just a few feet away from the guard, who was meticulously inspecting the contents of his box, Harvey stifled an anxious laugh. If only the guard knew, he thought, that his escape kit was hiding in plain sight. Finding nothing of interest in the box, the guard moved on to the next prisoner and resumed his search. The following day, the weather clear and fine, Harvey and over 200 other officers prepared to leave the camp. The commandant gave an incomprehensible speech, praising the prisoners as men of honor. Then they headed out of the swamp, leaving Schwarmstedt. Once in the woods, three prisoners made a dash for it. Guards fired after them, but the men got away. Closer to Hadamsdorf station, another prisoner broke free. Bullets fired by the guards tore at tree stumps, but missed their mark. But then the fugitive stumbled in a ditch, and the guards giving chase successfully tackled him. Harvey bided his time. He figured the train offered the best chance of escaping undetected, while giving him the advantage of a head start. He had his route to freedom carefully planned, thanks to Captain Godfrey Fillimore, who had escaped Schwarmstedt, only to be captured just shy of the border. After 12 nights on the run, he was returned to the camp. He'd shared every detail with Harvey and the Pink Toes, from the route he had followed to advice on when to travel, after midnight to avoid chance encounters, the best cover growth, rye, and places to avoid, damp woods and mosquitoes that rob you of vitality. Finally, he cautioned them to abandon all roads and circumvent all villages within 30 miles of the frontier. Once he and the other men had boarded the train, Harvey stashed his knapsack, filled with some tins of meat and several slabs of Canadian hardtack, for his journey to the border, in a lavatory in the corridor. Then he entered his carriage and took a seat. The guard in his compartment was positioned at the door, with a rifle between his legs. The opposite door was locked. Harvey planned on waiting until after dusk, excusing himself to go to the lavatory, exiting through the window, and jumping, preferably when the train was on a slow uphill course. His compartment mates, wise to his intentions, made several trips to the lavatory in the first few hours of the journey.